Scott Westerfeldt is the author of 18 novels, including the best-selling Uglies and Leviathan series. His worlds are hugely varied, spanning dystopian futures where plastic surgery is compulsory, steampunk retellings of the First World War, and parasite-infected vampires. I'm hugely pleased to have him on the show. Scott Westerfeldt, welcome to the book club.
Thank you for having me.
So your most recent series is the Leviathan books, so Leviathan, Behemoth, and Goliath. I'm a big fan of them, and I usually describe it as steampunk plus World War One plus cross-dressing plus pictures. So I might start. I might start with the illustrations. What's the story behind the pictures in Leviathan?
Well, I was writing a book set in 1914, and it's an adventure novel for teenagers. So I thought it'd be interesting to go back and read the the adventure novels that particularly boys would have been reading back then. You know, the stuff with airships and derring do and all sorts of stuff like that. And as I read them, I realized that the illustrations were a big part of it. Of course, 100 years ago, every book had illustrations, whether it was Jane Austen or Sherlock Holmes or a book for teenagers. Basically, every novel had illustrations, and those only started to die out in the 1920s. So I thought it would be really cool to have a book set in 1914 that felt like a book from 1914 and that had illustrations, even though it was for, teenagers who are 14, 15, and usually don't get pictures in their books. So I contacted an artist named Keith Thompson, who had this wonderful sort of, strange combination of weird creatures and really interesting machines, which is kind of what my book is about. And, that's part of his style. So we got together and started writing together.
Mm. And how did that collaboration work?
Well, I just said we wrote together, which is probably not true, but I would send him a few chapters, and then we would sort of together figure out which things should be illustrated. And then he would send me sketches. And sometimes, I felt like the sketches weren't quite right. I would tell him, no, this should look a little different. But quite often, his sketches, although they wouldn't match my text, they would be better than my text in some way. They would be like, he's a pretty good engineer because he's had to do a lot of work with video games and things like that. You have to understand how things work. So quite often, his sort of mechanical solutions to the machines I was describing would be better than the way I described them. So I would rewrite, to reflect his designs. Mm-hmm. And another thing that happened quite often was sometimes he would... there would be some sort of creature or machine in the book that I thought would only be there for one chapter, but what he drew was just so awesome that it would have to come back. Like a very popular guest star on a TV show. Like, at first you think they're only going to be there for a couple of episodes, but everyone loves them, so they have to keep coming back.
Hmm. Sounds like a hugely fun way to write a book.
It is. It's really interesting. I mean, I think it's, in a way, I guess comic book writers, go through this sort of experience more often than text writers like myself, text-only writers who write regular novels.
Mm.
Another thing that happened quite often was I would write a scene and maybe there'd be five people in it, and then he'd send it back and there would only be three people in the sketch. So what are the other ones? He's like, hey, it's kind of crowded. And I would realize that he was right, not only at a visual level, but also at a narrative level.
Mm.
It made more sense to cut it back to what looked good on the page.
Mm.
As well. That just had more drama just to reduce the number of people and to cut it back. So it's amazing how often visualizing something changes the story.
Mm. And how else did sort of the visualization, how did it impact the way you thought about maybe planning the story and producing new material for it?
Yeah, well, there was one case where as we got into it more, and as we started, a lot of the story takes place on this giant airship, just sort of fanciful airship made from the life threads of a whale. And we started to do a few sort of deck plans, so we sort of knew where everything was. And there were a couple of rooms that were sort of left over. We hadn't visited them yet. And he started drawing things in those rooms and saying, well, that'll be the radio room. That'll be the this or the that. And there's one case where he put a cable between two parts of the ship, just as a structural element. And I said, well, someone's got to slide down that cable. That looks like that would be a lot of fun. So in a way, just having the space and creating the space with these stories were going to happen, gave me more ideas and opened up this potential for more drama and interesting, cool things to happen.
And you and Keith, you went on to, you've produced sort of a companion to the Leviathan series, the Manual of Aeronautics?
Yes, it's basically all the stuff that we made that didn't make it into the books. For example, the deck plans and the uniforms. And the illustrations of the books are in black and white, but because we were doing just, because we were just doing a 64-page art book, we decided we could do that in color. So now you have the people who want to do cosplay and stuff like that have an opportunity to see things in color, and it was fun to like build the world out by having it come into color.
Mm. The Leviathan books, they're an alternative version of history. So the Alliance and the Axis powers are sort of remolded into the Darwinists and the Clankers, pitting the beasties, the modified creatures of the Darwinists against the machines. How did you go about balancing these fantasy and these science fiction elements with actual history?
Well, because I was sort of, making this radical departure from history, which is that basically in my world, Charles Darwin discovered DNA and started making creatures. So the Victorian Empire was built on the backs of these modified animals. And because I was making such a big change there, I decided to rather unrealistically keep the rest of the war exactly the same, where the Archduke Ferdinand is killed on the same day. Every country enters the war the same day. In a weird way, we became obsessive about making things historically accurate because we were making such a big change to the world in general. So it's like the big things are different, but the little things are the same.
Mm. So all the way down to buttons and curse words and all that type of thing.
Well, Keith is relentless about that kind of stuff. He's actually, there were a few cases where I would try to pick apart his, like, say, oh, that pistol looks wrong. And he always had the answers and always knew better than I did exactly what, what kind of riding crop someone would be holding in 1914.
Mm. One of my favourite phrases from the books is barking spiders, which one of the characters, Darren, says all the time. Was that an actual curse phrase that you looked up, or is it one that you invented?
It's a little bit of both. It definitely existed. I'm not sure it was used the way I use it.
And also with the history, you were talking about things staying the same in terms of the historical details, and yet you have Alec, who's one of the other main characters, who in the book, he's the son of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie. And of course, in history, Alec never existed.
That's true. They did have kids, but they were three kids, and they had different names and weren't quite as old as Alec.
Mm.
So I did sort of compress the family and make it a little easier to deal with.
Mm.
But I've always thought, like when your parents die, it's like the world is broken. And that's a really intense kind of experience. But for those kids, when their parents died, the world really did break. I mean, every day for the next 4 years, every time they opened up the newspaper, every page had an article on it about this war that happened because of their own family tragedy.
Hmm.
So I just like the idea of seeing the war through that. This incredibly vast war that's hard to keep track of because it goes to every continent almost.
Mm.
And just the idea that that would be related to you so personally made it sort of a fascinating kind of YA character to write.
Yeah, so you have Alec, who's the orphan son of the Archduke, and you also have Darren, who's a midshipman aboard the Leviathan, the big whale cross ship. And when I was thinking about it, you've got many dualities in your series. So you have two main characters, one's a girl, one's a boy. You've got one who's a commoner and one who's a royal, and both of them are keeping very important secrets. Was this a natural balance for you, or one that you put a lot of thought into?
Yeah, no, it is something I wanted to balance out. I like characters with secrets in general, and having two main characters who are keeping secrets from each other is particularly interesting, especially as they start to unwind them. Mm. And as, of course, one of them figures out the secret before the other, makes for a sort of interesting imbalance in their information. Another thing that came up more naturally, I think, is that at the beginning, Alec is kind of depressed because his parents have just been murdered, of course, and he's sort of everything he knows about himself has been called into question. And because there was a kind of intensity to him and a kind of broodingness to him at the beginning of the novel, I thought, to balance that out, I had to make Darren a much more fun character who's having basically the time of her life. So, that was something that just came out of the writing to create a more natural balance, but it really made her into a really fun character because I had to keep punching up how great her life is because hers is, at least in the beginning, depressing.
Even though her life is very much in constant danger of being sort of torn down into pieces because she's pretending to be a boy in the Navy.
Right, that's true. She could lose it all, but at the same time, she is having the time of her life.
Yeah. No, and you've got a very intriguing support cast as well. You've got Dr. Barlow and Count Vulgar and Bovril, the small creature. Would you like to tell us a little bit about him?
The small creature, Bovril, is basically a genetically modified creature, one of the Darwinist creations. And it's not quite clear. Now, he doesn't really hatch until book two. And so I don't want to spoil too much. But he was intended as a gift for the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire to keep them out of the war. And the interesting thing about the creature is that it does talk. Many of the Darwinist creatures, they repeat things said to them, like message lizards, like parrots. But this creature seems to have a kind of intelligence behind what it says. And that makes Bovril a really interesting, sort of interesting way for the author to interject things, you know, to create a certain amount of comedy or attention or whatever needs to be said that the characters wouldn't naturally say. So it's kind of like my mouthpiece in the book. He only has to say like one word every once in a while to change everything.
And Bovril is absolutely adored by most Leviathan readers. I was actually wondering, did the little beastie start off with something that was supposed to have so much personality, or was it something that naturally grew into something much larger than its size?
When I actually was first writing Leviathan, I didn't know what was in the eggs. I didn't know what was going to come out of them. I kind of was completely winging it. I quite often like creatures that talk or machines that talk or, you know, just sort of human characters. Like even a stuffed animal that a character talks to can be quite interesting because they tend to bring out responses that regular human characters don't. So that's the thing I've used a few times in my work.
And your books as a group are quite hard, I think, to put into sort of a single basket or genre or what have you. You've written science fiction, you've written contemporary fiction, you've written dystopia, and of course the Leviathan books. Do you have a preference or are they all sort of the same to you?
Yeah, they feel the same to me because I'm more aware of my similarities than anything else. And the good thing about being a writer for teenagers is that all your books wind up in the teen department, in the YA department. Mm. So, you know, whereas if I were an adult writer, some of them would be in sort of contemporary realism, some would be in fiction or fantasy, science fiction, but they're all stuck together because they're teen books, and it's kind of a nice place to be for that reason. I think teens are more universal readers. I mean, if you look at like a 12-year-old bringing home a stack of books, they'll have a biography of their favorite star and a crime book and a sort of problem novel and a fantasy book and a book about sharks. And adults don't read that widely, really. Adults tend to specialize like we do in the rest of our lives and get more focused on one kind of book that we know will give us what we want. But teenagers and younger readers tend to be a bit more, you know, open to lots of different genres and lots of different things. I mean, they go through phases where they only read one thing, but those phases come and go.
And you're very engaged with your readership and with your fan base. I mean, you've got a blog, you post fan art, you do a huge amount of stuff. Is this a big effort for you to balance with your writing?
It's an effort, but it gives me a lot back. I mean, I think interacting with teenagers is really valuable. I particularly like the fan art that's come out of the world of Leviathan and seeing how kids represent the characters that they fall in love with and how they want to contribute into that conversation of the illustrations and how they redo things. Like, I've seen Alec and Darren done as manga characters or as My Little Pony characters. And so there's these sort of weird crossovers where they... You know, and one of the really interesting things is quite often the fan art and fan fiction about my characters will be about kind of boring things, like just hanging out. And I realize that quite often in books, we rob our characters of those times where you're just hanging out and talking to your friends, because everything's more sort of like straight to the story, straight to the action. So those missing moments that we zip over of kind of boring conversations, hanging out, talking, are quite often the subject of fan fiction and fan art, which I think is kind of an interesting thing for a writer to recognize.
And speaking of missing scenes, you actually wrote a postscript to the Leviathan series, which you posted on your blog as sort of an extra chapter. How did that one come about?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I got, you know, you get the usual thing. Whenever you write a series, you get a certain amount of mail saying, well, this series should be in, it should go on, and there should be more, and this is what should happen next. And, you know, I knew I wasn't going to do more Leviathan, but I did have the idea. I felt like a lot of people had said to me, we never got to see Darren actually wearing a dress, like her dressed as a woman, which is a sort of tradition of the cross-dressing narrative. It's something at the end, you see them, and, you know, I kind of intentionally avoided that in the book, but I thought as a sort of as an exercise in fan service that I would create something like that. But I also decided to put Alec in a dress as well. So basically, there's this sort of fancy dress party, and they're both dressed up as women, and Bovril is also dressed up. So it was just kind of a kind of comic chapter to look back at the kinds of things that people, you know, that fans wanted in the book that never wound up being in the book.
Mm. And are you working on anything else at the moment?
Yes, right now I'm working on a kind of complicated book called Afterworld.
Kind of complicated.
Well, it's actually two books. The odd numbered chapters are even numbered chapters are sort of a paranormal romance. And the odd numbered chapters are about the 18-year-old girl who wrote that paranormal romance and had it published and her experiences in New York, in the publishing world, in the YA publishing world.
I like the sound of that.
Oh, good. I'm sure, you know, there's so many kids who are writing these days. Mm. You know, fan fiction writers, there's approximately, I think, last year for National Novel Writing Month, which is this big tradition where everybody tries to write a novel in November. Mm. And there were 50,000 teenagers in the U.S. who signed up for the Young Writers version of that. And I'm sure there's another 250,000 people who were all writing novels at that time. I'm sure some of those were teenagers as well. Mm. So I'm 50. When I was a teenager, if I told anyone I was writing a novel, they would have just laughed at me and said, that's ridiculous, teenagers don't do that. But now it's very much a process of being a reader. A part of being a reader is you might take a stab at writing a novel. And you tell me about the fan fiction, about the place you could put your novel where other kids can read it. So there's a lot more of that kind of literary activity, paraliterary activity of people writing for each other. And I think that's wonderful and fascinating, and I want to support it. So one way to do that is to sort of write a narrative about a young writer.
Mm. As I said, I really like the sound of it, and I do very much look forward to reading it when it comes out. Scott Westerfeld, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to The Book Club.